Okay. Last session of the day. Let me get to rest for a bit. It's a lot to take in, so hopefully it's not like drinking from the fire hose. But we want to value your time and make sure you're learning as much as we can, or as much as you can during the time that you're here. Anyway, so this final section is going to build a little bit on the eunuch stuff, in that hopefully we'll get some opportunity to practice using some of the eunuch things when we do some model fitting here in a second. But for this final session, before I go into anything really, I want you guys to have a little bit of discussion amongst yourselves and think about what is a scientific model. And so go for it, and then we'll come back in a couple minutes and see what you guys come up with. Okay, you guys started last time. Why don't you guys go this time?
A way to quantify data, or to use like a predictive.
Mm-hmm. Just look at the second. You look at the second slide. No, it's okay. No, it's good. Yep. I mean, definitely there's some quantification in there. What did you guys come up with?
A way to represent some sort of system process and data, a way to represent some complex thing in a simpler way that's only meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the meaning is a big part of it too, is you know, are we coming up with something that helps us understand how the world works, right? If you're thinking about a complex process, anything from you know, how the planets orbit the sun, to you know, how a particular chemical reaction works, trying to grasp that in your head all at once at any given time is a rather difficult thing to do. And so one of the things that a model should do is make things easier for us to understand. It should be ideally quantitative, so it's not sufficient to say, you know, this is a model and have it not actually be able to predict anything. And so the third thing would be predictive. And so the next slide, I have some properties that I was able to come up with, and we've already covered a lot of these, right? So there's some kind of observable quantity that we're trying to understand. Again, that observable quantity could be anything from, you know, physicists will again think about, you know, the nature of dark energy, or something very simple like the orbits of the planets, or something you know, very chemical or biochemical like the mechanism at which a chemical reaction proceeds. But there's some kind of observable quantity that we're trying to relate. So maybe in the orbits of the planets, we're thinking about understanding the time it takes for each planet to orbit the sun. Or perhaps in dark energy, we're trying to think about the clustering of galaxies in the universe. And why don't we have a big distribution that's even, and instead we have sort of small clusters. On the other hand, you could think of, for the chemical reaction, what mechanistic steps are taking place? How do those mechanistic steps then go in and explain the observable, which would be the rate, some other type of observable, like atomic incorporation, if we use some kind of heavy atom substitution. So we're always trying to relate something quantitative to something observable. And if there's no observable, you can hand wave around the solar system, but without a model, without something that you're trying to actually be able to predict, an observable quantity, it's really not a model. And in that terms, you also have things in the model called parameters, right? So in the solar system example, your parameters might be the masses and the distance, or the average distances of the planets from the sun. In the enzyme mechanism example, it might be the rate constants that go into calculating the rate of the particular chemical reaction you're looking at. And so these things are generally things that might vary to a certain extent. You might have an idea of what they are. For example, you might have an idea if a rate constant is on the order of 10 to the 10th versus on the order of 10 to the 6th, depending on if it's diffusion controlled. Or you might not have an idea, but you might just have to make a few educated guesses. So we might not necessarily know what the mass of Jupiter is, but we can make some educated guesses about that. And generally, the parameters are sort of what we're interested in, right? If we're looking to explain the orbital time of Jupiter, we can, in some sense, measure the orbital time. So it's not like we're dying to know what the orbital time is. We can just measure it in the sky. But we can explain that in terms of the mass of Jupiter. Well, that gets us something out that we might not be able to measure directly. So the mass would be something that we might not be able to measure directly. In the same way, there's not an easy way to measure a rate constant intrinsically, right? We access that by throwing the materials together, measuring the rate, and then back calculating what the rate constant is. And so these parameters are telling us something physical, but in another sense, they're the fundamental parts, or the components, the things that make up the models that we're looking at. And finally, the models that we're interested in should be predictive. If I come up with a model for calculating the rate of a particular chemical reaction, and that model can't predict the rate at a different temperature, it's only good for one set of conditions. Well, it might be a valid model, but it's not a very good one. Good models are predictive in that you can take the parameters at one set of values and then predict the behavior at a different set of conditions. And so, when we think about models, at least from a biophysical or a biochemical point of view, we have something a little bit more in mind or a little bit more specific than, say, what you might have built with as a kid if you were building model airplanes or something like that. We're really trying to be able to understand the physical observables that we can then measure in the lab. And so some very common models that come up in biochemistry often look like equations, right? So this is where some of the math comes in. And indeed, I think thinking about equations is probably one of the easiest way to think about what a model is. And so this is a model for single site binding. So in biophysics, this would be our protein, so represented by P. This L would be our ligand, represented by L. This could be a small molecule drug. It could be another protein that's interacting with the first protein, but they come together to form this very simple equilibrium where there's a protein-ligand complex. And you know, you can write down things like the equilibrium constant for this chemical reaction. You can talk about the enthalpy. Similarly, you have things that you know. Generally, if you mix up a protein and a small molecule in a test tube, you know the total protein concentration, you know the ligand concentration. What you might not necessarily know is the equilibrium constant, right? I mean, that's if you're looking at some totally new interaction, you might not be able to go up into a book and look that up. So this is the equation that describes the degree of binding, or how much protein is bound, or the fraction of protein bound, as a function of three things, really. The total protein concentration, P naught, the total ligand concentration, L naught, and the K, the equilibrium constant. So in this model, you know, protein and ligand total concentration is something we know. That's not really a parameter. That's a fundamental constant for this system. But the thing that's the parameter is the equilibrium constant. And so by measuring this, this is our observable. So presumably there's some way to access the fraction of protein bound experimentally. By measuring that, using different fixed values of P naught and L naught, we can understand, or we can see, which value of the equilibrium constant best describes the behavior we observe for the degree of binding as a function of protein concentration. Right? So this is a very simple mathematical model. I mean, derivation is not necessarily trivial, but it can be done. And in this case, K, the equilibrium constant, would be our parameter. The degree of binding would be our observed value. And P naught and L naught would be, you know, sort of inputs to the model that we put in. Another equation would be this simple phase transition, right, where we have you know, something in one state going into another state. Now in protein work, this is often represented with protein folding, right? So we have our protein in its folded state versus the protein in the unfolded state. So two sides of this chemical reaction. Again, it can be represented by an equilibrium constant. And here, if we think about the fraction folded, or the number of molecules that are in the native state relative to the total number of protein molecules, you can derive that fraction is equal to 1 over 1 plus k. And using some thermodynamics, you can express that fraction folded in terms of the enthalpy and the entropy of folding. And so now, again, we can predict the fraction folded given the temperature. And in this case, we have two parameters. We have an enthalpy and an entropy of the folding reaction. So again, not very easy to get at or to understand intrinsically what the enthalpy or the entropy is. But if we do enough measurements of our observable, which is the fraction folded, at different values of the temperature, we should be able to extract what values of enthalpy and entropy give us the best agreement from the model to the data. And so these are two very common biochemical models, but one that often comes up and probably is a little bit easier to understand, even if it's not necessarily biochemically based, is radioactive decay. And so, you know, this is barium-137, some experimental data showing you the number of decay events. So again, you put up your Geiger counter to your sample of barium, and you measure the number of counts in a given amount of time. And you see a large number of counts early on, but as time goes on and most of the sample has decayed, you see that decay rate eventually approaches a flat value. It's not zero, right, because your Geiger counter picks up background radiation. So unless you're in a totally isolated lead box, and even then you're still going to have some cosmic rays, unless you're in a totally isolated situation, you're never going to approach zero, but you will approach a certain constant background radiation measurement that your Geiger counter picks up, you know, 5, 10, 20 counts every 30 seconds. And so this has a model that probably many of you are familiar with. It's simple exponential decay, right? So this here, again, in terms of the vocabulary that we've described, our model has parameters, in which case, well, it has our observable, which is the number of counts in a given time. It has parameters, so one of those parameters is the background radiation, B, the initial number of counts detected, A, and then the half-life of decay, which is T1 half. And again, this we're not going to talk about how this is derived, but essentially this is the equation that we expect to describe the behavior of the radioactive decay for this particular molecule. And really, probably what we're really after is understanding what the half-life is, right? So that's a parameter in the sense that we have an estimate of what it is, but we'd like to get a nice, strong numerical value for the half-life of barium-137. And so this is sort of the task that we're going to use to introduce how we can do model fitting, really, because the problem that we're facing here is we have an observable, we have an equation, we have some unknowns. How do we find the values of the unknowns that give us the best agreement between our model and the observed data? So this model says that at a certain time we should be able to detect C counts of radioactive decay events. But it's dependent on the A, the B, and the T1 half. So how do we find those values that give us the best agreement between our equation and the data that we actually observe? And so that's where we're going to jump through basically an entire 2 weeks of statistics, and I'm going to give you the answer. So the answer to say how do we find the best parameters is we define a function here called chi-squared. This is called normalized chi-squared if you're keeping track. Where we basically minimize the difference between the observed values, so again, these would be the actual data points, and the values that we predict for those observations using our model, right? So that the f of x here represents the values predicted by our model for a given set of parameters. Intrinsic in this f of x is that f of x depends on things like the initial number of counts, the background radiation, as well as the half-life. And so we could imagine if we take this function, and we're going to ignore this sigma for now, but if we take this function and we change half-life a little bit, and if that change reduces the difference between our observed points and our actual predicted values, then chi-squared is going to go down. If we change the half-life a little bit more, and that further reduces the difference, that means that our half-life is getting closer and closer to the best value that describes the optimal agreement between our observed values and the model data. On the other hand, if we change our half-life, let's say we make it bigger, and this difference becomes worse or larger, then that difference squared is going to become even bigger. And now chi-squared will start to go up, right? And so hopefully what you can see from this is that suppose we could determine perfect agreement between our observed values and our model data, then this would be zero, and chi-squared would be zero as well. If the model and the observed values are drastically different, then this difference here is going to be large, and chi-squared is going to be correspondingly large as well, right? So we can use this term chi-squared to understand or to optimize the parameters that we want, and when we find that we've reached the minimum of chi-squared, we can be confident that the parameters that we have from that minimization routine are the best parameters that we can possibly get out of our observations. Now, there's some other things that we didn't mention here, This N sub D is called the number of degrees of freedom. This is taking into account the fact that if you have a line and you draw 2 points between it, it's not terribly meaningful to have a good agreement between your observed and your model data, right? And so if I have a line which would have two parameters, the slope and the intercept, and I have two observable points, well, I can always draw a straight line between those two observable points and have perfect agreement between the model and the observed values. So that in that case, that's not a terribly meaningful value. If I would have two observations, two parameters, this would go to zero, and now you have 1/0. That means your chi-square is still infinity, and it's not actually small in that case. So that's one way to sort of get about the fact that you can't overfit, or you can't have a model with 15 parameters get a meaningful fit when you only have 4 data points, right? So you can't have that. The other thing here is the uncertainty. And so basically what I'm doing is I'm summing up the difference, that's what the sigma means, over every data point that I have, right? But some data points I might have a very tight precision on, I might know very, very well. And other data points I might say, well, you know, I'm only in a ballpark. And so this sigma here represents the uncertainty for that data point. If that uncertainty is quite large, that means I'm not going to penalize this number. I'm going to divide this difference by a large number, and it's not going to have a very large penalty for being off by quite a bit. If my uncertainty, on the other hand, is very small for a given point, then I would expect that my model and my observed data points would agree quite well, and if they don't, I'm actually going to give it a worse penalty. I'm going to make it contribute to my chi-square so that it has a very big contribution. Okay, now this is all very mathematical. We're going to try to get at this with some actual real practical play, I think is probably the best word for it. So hopefully you all have access to a browser. Online you can download, I'm pretty sure you can download the binding worksheet, I think it's the radioactive decay worksheet. Yeah, exponential decay worksheet. And you want to enable editing. And so you see when you open this, you can't see because it's on the thing. When you open this file, went to the website and clicked exponential decay worksheet. Everybody have it?
No.
Okay, we'll give you another second. So while you're opening it, so this is the same data we were just looking at in the slide presentation, and in orange, or whatever color you want to call this, is our quote-unquote best fit. Now, it's not a very good fit, is it? Even without any kind of, you know, statistical training at all, you can look at this model, or this curve, which represents our model, and the black points, and you can immediately say, well, that's not a very good fit to the data. So our goal here is to understand how this function is optimized or minimized when our agreement between our model and our data points is best. Okay, and so that's the goal of this worksheet. So, Jared, do you have it now?
Yes.
Okay, great. So if you look in the worksheet, there's several different sheets down here at the bottom, or chart sheets, I guess, is what Excel calls them. We're right now looking at the graph with the fit. You can also look at the original data, which is what I used to make the slide. We'll talk here about the residuals in a little bit. But if you click on the data sheet, this is the actual data that are used to generate that particular graph. And what there are a few what's on this graph is, in addition to the time, so those are the x values on the graph. You have the y values here, so those are the observed counts in 30 seconds. You have an uncertainty for each of them, corresponding to, you know, you might have a better, you know, in this case, if you have 168 counts, your uncertainty is going to be a smaller number than if you have 4 counts. And so that represents what's going on there. And these first 3 columns are essentially what you see when you look here in the graph. Okay, now if you're curious about how to do Excel error bars and all that, we can talk later. I do offer a class here at State on using Excel, but if you're coming from Huntsville, you probably won't be able to take that. Anyway, so we can talk about that. But those first 3 columns are basically what you see with no model values at all. What we have here in the 4th column is, this is the value that we would expect to observe using the model parameters up here in this little box here. And so right now, I have my initial height as defined at 70. It's actually 70 plus the background, but don't worry about that. My half-life I've estimated at 50 seconds. And my background radiation, I'm assuming, is 0. Okay, and so what I can do is, if I mouse over this and look at the formula, so I'll click in here. And again, I assume a little bit of background with Excel. I figure most people have at least seen Excel before. But what is it doing? Well, here it's B6, which corresponds to this blue cell here. So that's our A. And then we have an exponential value. Natural log of 2 is just a constant. B7 is our half-life, shown here in red. And A15 is our time. And then at the very end, we add B8, which is our background radiation. And so this equation in here represents the model that we saw in the previous slide. So that represents this model. We have constant times exponential term that involves the half-life plus background. What we have in the formula again is constant, B6, times exponential term that involves the half-life plus the background radiation. So this equation is basically using these values here to calculate the expected number of counts we would observe at this given time, using the parameters that we've set up in those cells. And you can see that the way this is set up is that if I change the half-life, for example, so let's suppose I make that 60, it changes all of the values that are calculated here using the model parameters. And so I can make the half-life small, and you can see that now the expected decay with the short half-life goes down very quickly. If I look here at the graph with fit, essentially it decays almost instantaneously. And this graph with fit is basically just plotting those 2 curves, the original data plus the new data calculated at each point. If I make this value big, suppose like 500 seconds or so, again, now these are decaying very slowly. And if I look at the graph, you can see the decay has gotten much, much longer. Now, in addition to the first 3 columns, which represents the observed data, the 4th column, which represents the value I would calculate given a specific set of model parameters, the 5th column represents the difference between those two values, the observed value and the value that I calculate from the model, right? And so what is that? Well, that is simply yi minus f of xi in this equation. That's the difference between our observed value, y, and the value that we calculate from the model, f of x, given a specific set of parameters. And then each one of those is going to make a contribution to chi-squared. Okay, so in particular, it's going to depend on the square of this value, right? The square of that difference divided by the square of the uncertainty. And sure enough, if I look at this equation, the contribution to chi-squared is E12 or E15 squared divided by C15 squared, right? And all that is yi minus f of xi squared divided by sigma I squared. And so now all I have to do is sum all of those up, and I get something that's going to be proportional to chi squared. So every data point makes a contribution to the final chi squared value. If the sum of all of those contributions is small, then chi squared will be small, and I have good agreement between my model and my observed values. If the sum of all of those contributions is big, then the chi squared will be big, and I don't have so good of agreement. Okay, now how do I know what small and what big are? Well, that's where this normalization comes in. Okay, and so you can think of this normalization, this number of degrees of freedom, as a way of sort of telling us, is my chi-squared relatively large, or is it on track, or is it really small? You can imagine that suppose I have 15 data points, and I fit a model to those data points. Each of those data points is going to have an uncertainty. In this case, the uncertainty is represented by sigma. If the difference between those data points and my observed value is about the same as sigma, well then this difference, y minus f, divided by sigma is going to be approximately equal to 1, right? So very, very simply thinking, I could think if I sum up, if I have 15 data points, each of them on average is about the distance of one uncertainty from the observed value. So y minus or y over sigma is approximately 1. 15, well, 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, 15 times, gives me a chi-squared of approximately 15. If I divide that by the number of degrees of freedom, the number of degrees of freedom is also going to be, it's not going to be exactly 15, but it's going to be on the same order. So if I divide that by the number of degrees of freedom, a chi-squared where every one of my data points is about one uncertainty away from the observed value will be about equal to 1. And so the purpose of this normalization factor is a way to sort of show you that if my chi-squared is equal to about 1 or less, that means my difference between my observed points and my model is either equal to or less than the uncertainty of each data point. Okay, so again, we're oscillating back here. We're taking some time. We're talking about the equations. We're going to go back now into Excel and sort of play with this and see how it works. But the best way to sort of make this connection is to get a feeling for both how is this behaving versus how does the theory work out. And so again, in here, you can see all of these have a relatively large contribution to chi-squared. That's what I would expect because all of these points, you know, the difference between this point and this point is almost, you know, 100 counts. The difference between these points is relatively small, but then, you know, the distance over here again is relatively large. And so we would expect that up to about 200 seconds or so, we're making significant contributions to chi-squared. For this range 200 to 400, our contributions to chi-squared should be fairly small. And then for the rest of it, we should have smaller but still significant contributions to chi-squared, which again make chi-squared much higher than it probably should be for a good fit. And so let's go back and look at our data. So up to about 200 seconds, that's about here, you see we have a big difference. From 200 to 400, our difference is fairly small, so 1 is about minus 6. Or if we look at the squared value, it's even smaller still. And then it gets big again. It gets up to 12, 17, 15, 10, and so forth. And so our reduced chi-squared, when we basically sum all of those up and divide by the number of degrees of freedom, ends up being about 9.87. So again, all you can see here is I've basically summed up this entire column and then divided by B11. And what's B11? But B11 is 37. So again, number of data points minus the number of parameters in our model, which is 3. So we have 40 data points minus 3 gives us 37 degrees of freedom. And I also repeat the reduced chi-square up here because I don't want to keep having to scroll down to the bottom of my worksheet. Okay, so now what do I do? Well, now I can actually go in and I can actually do some playing here. So I can say, well, how on earth does the chi-squared behave if I start making some of the changes to the parameters and try to make this a slightly better fit? Okay, so now I can go in here and I can just sit and try random values. So if I make this 30, now chi-squared becomes big, bigger. If I make this 500, that's the number we were just at, it becomes smaller, but it's still 9 instead of 1. Let's make it 750. Well, now it's getting bigger again. And so what you can see is that I could just try random numbers in here, and eventually I would come to a position where I would have a fairly low value of chi-squared. That's not how a computer does it. Generally, that's not how I recommend you guys do it. And so a better way to do this would be to actually look at the graph and say, well, okay, I don't necessarily know what my half-life is, but I have a real good handle on what it means for my background radiation to be, you know, a particular value, and I have a very good estimate of the starting value of this curve, right? And so let's instead of trying to guess values of my half-life that I think might fit, let's use an unrealistic value of the half-life that's fairly small, and we can go in and we can say, okay, let's make the half-life 20 seconds. Again, what I can see here is that, yeah, there's no way this is 20 seconds, but I have a really good feeling for what the first time point is, and I have a pretty good feeling for what the background should be. And so let's go in now, and if I look here, the background is somewhere around maybe about 10 counts per 30 seconds. So I can change that, make that 10. Yeah, it's not so bad. And now I can also tweak the first value, the starting value, to try to get that up so that it's fairly close. And so let's see, that first value is going to be about 170. And 170 minus 10 is 160, so I can go in here, let's say 160. So now I have a fairly realistic value for A, my initial time point, and B, my background. My chi-squared is pretty awful. It's 17. But now what I can do is I can say, okay, well, looking at how this curve behaves, I know my exponential decay is going to be longer than 20 seconds. So let's try 100 seconds and see what that does. So my chi-square starts out at 17.8. If I make it 100 seconds, well, now it goes down to 2.3. So that's definitely a lower chi-squared value. And sure enough, if I look at the fit, the agreement between the model and the experimental data is much smaller. I can make it a little bit bigger still. So let's try 120. And now my chi-squared is below 1, so 0.831. And again, if I switch to my graph, I would expect that on average, the curve is differing from the data by about an error bar, or by about one measure of the uncertainty. And if I go here, again, many of these points are within one measure of the uncertainty here. And so I can continue to tweak this. Let's try 140. And it's still going down. 150. Now it's starting to go back up again. So I know my minimum is somewhere between 140 and 150. So now I can try 145. Well, it's still better at 140, so I think we can try 142. Oops, wrong one. 142. Now it's 0.539, 143, 0.559, 141, 0.521. So we're actually pretty close when we get to a half-life of about 140. And if we look at our data, yeah, that's not bad. One can say from chi-squared, again, from statistics, that it's statistically meaningful because chi-squared is less than 1. One can look at the graph and say, yeah, that seems like it's a pretty good fit, and say, yeah, no, those values of the parameters seem like they make sense. Well, that's totally different, but you can look at the fit and have it make sense graphically. It makes sense to have a half-life of about 140 seconds, given that if I look at 140 seconds, yeah, a pretty good number of it's decayed at 140 seconds. So the parameters I'm getting seem to make sense given the data I observe. And so basically we've just fit a model, right? We fit some model, or fit a model to the data. And we've extracted meaningful values of the parameters that give us fairly good agreement between the observations that we've made and the model that we think should describe how the decay should look. Really, that's all a computer is doing, right? I think it's helpful. I mean, I can go in and I can show you some optimization tools and some programming language and things to show you how computer, what commands you need to optimize some model parameters to an observed data set. But I think it makes much more sense to sit here and try to play with it and grapple with the idea that you are trying to find values of a parameter that give you good agreement between the observed values and the model that you calculate. And once you get the best agreement possible, then you know that the values of the parameters make some degree of graphical sense, and you could use this chi-squared metric as a way of assessing how good your fit is. Okay, now a computer isn't going to go there and sort of make some guesses, and it can't, you know, computers don't have eyes, so they can't look at a graph, and so their approach to solving this problem is going to be quite different from how you and I would do it. But fundamentally, it's the same kind of thing. It's a search problem. And if you go here to the next slide, I have some pictures here of minimizing chi-squared. And so in this case, you know, this would be the case where you have like an equilibrium constant, and you have some kind of observable value where you're measuring chi-squared. And as you change the equilibrium constant, you see that chi-squared goes down, 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 down. And then eventually it starts going up again. And at this point where chi-squared is the minimum, that represents the point where your equilibrium constant gives you the value that is in best agreement with whatever you're observing, whether that's protein folding data or binding data or whatever. For the case where you have lots of parameters, so in this case with the exponential decay, we had three parameters. We had the background radiation, the half-life, and the initial starting value. lots more parameters, more complex search space, but it's still fundamentally the same. You know, you can still imagine that there's some kind of chi-squared surface. And as you change, you know, in this case, this would be a two-dimensional fit where you have like a slope and an intercept of a straight line. As you change the slope and the intercept, chi-squared becomes bigger or smaller. And at the position where you've minimized chi-squared, that's the best fit between your linear data and your linear model. Okay, and so basically, you're working to change the parameters in such a way that you optimize the agreement of your model and data using the chi-squared metric as a way to assess whether you're doing a good job. Now, specifically, how is this done? Right, we've gone in, and I would say these values that we've come up with are actually quite good, but you can actually use Excel to do this numerically. So that Excel will go in and it will actually do some calculations and it will optimize this for you so that you know that you've reached the numerical best value that you possibly can. I mean, you might not be 100% confident of yourself just guessing values and putting numbers in. But Excel can vary these things systematically and perform a digital search and try to find the best values that give you the absolute lowest values of chi-squared. To do it, you have to have a couple of things installed. So first of all, where is it? Maybe I haven't installed it here. Well, that'll be good. So you have to install a feature in Excel called the solver. And that's not enabled by default. I'm not sure why, it's exceedingly useful. But we're gonna go here to Options, Add-ins. And we're gonna enable the solver add-in. And now when I go to the Data tab in Microsoft Excel, you can see that I have a new button here called Solver. Okay, so what I did for doing that, and this is mostly for the recording, I go back into File, I select Options in Excel. Within that Options menu, there's a link called Add-ins. When I click on add-ins, it brings me this big list. At the very bottom of that list, I see this Manage Excel Add-ins. I hit Go. I check the solver add-in. I hit OK. And that enables the solver add-in. And then once again, I go to the Data tab in Excel. And now I'll see a little button there that says Solver to the far right. Okay, so I'm going to click on that, and what this is basically a way to do is to minimize any function, right? So it's going to basically tell me what value do you want to minimize, and what do you want me to try to change so that I make that value as small as possible. Now, it can also do maximization and other types of things, but we're not going to cover that. And it's fairly straightforward. I mean, for what it does, it's not a bad tool. It says, okay, our objective is the thing that we want to minimize. And so when we set the objective, we're going to set the objective to be equal to the reduced chi-squared value. Hit okay. And it says we want this to minimize, so we're going to select min. And it says by changing variable cells, and it asks me what cells do I want to change. Well, and I've done this before with this worksheet, and so it already knows to do B6 through B8. But if I click on this and then select the three parameters in my model, so you can see there's a method to why I set up my worksheet this way. Because all of my parameters are nice and in one place, it makes it very easy to set up. So I select B6 through B8, hit enter. I can add constraints here. There's other options for choosing the algorithm that it's going to use to minimize, but generally you don't have to worry about that. And I go down and I hit solve. And once I hit solve, this window comes up. It changes the values of those model parameters so that you can see that now the chi-squared is 0.434, so it's lower than what we came up with before. The background is 8.9, so it's not 10 anymore. The half-life is 144 seconds, and the initial height is 154. And it asks me, okay, do you like that? Does that seem reasonable? Sometimes you'll do this and it just blows up and you don't want to keep the answer. Those are usually more difficult to solve. I mean, this is just an exponential decay. If you have a model with 7 or 8 parameters and fewer numbers of data points, it's going to give you a harder time about it. But in this case, everything is fine, so I'm going to hit OK. If we look at our graph, the fit's even better. And now we can be confident that the computer has found what it thinks is the maximum or the best value of chi-squared that it possibly can. Now, I've drawn in this little sort of mini hypersurface a very artificially nice surface, right? I mean, there's clearly only one minimum there. On the other hand, you might have a much harder problem where there's multiple minima, or you can imagine that the surface is very rugged. It would be difficult for a computer to find the absolute global minimum in a situation where there's lots of little smaller minima. If, for example, instead of having the Marianas Trench there, we had something like the Rocky Mountains, right? So if you're asking it to find the minima, it might need some extra help in that situation. That's where looking at the data and doing what we did, where we said, well, you know, the background radiation is about 10. Giving it reasonable starting values can help it find the global minima a little bit easier. Okay, so, but fundamentally, it's just going through and trying to find a minimum. You know, it doesn't necessarily know what your function looks like. It's not looking at a graph. It's just trying to find the best value of chi-squared that it can. Okay, so think and discuss time. We came up with, the accepted value is 153 seconds. So that's, you know, if you go to the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics, our value from the fit that we just determined is 144.6. And so the question is our value good? Is it in agreement with the accepted value? And so that's something that again, I don't think there's a right answer for at this point that you guys could outline. But why don't you talk to your neighbor and see if, you know, what might you think or what might you want to consider about the way that we did our model fitting to see if the accepted value, if our model parameter value is within the limits of the accepted value. So discuss.
Yeah. And also, is it like, well,
Okay, what do you guys think?
It depends.
Okay, what do you want to elaborate, Robert?
So, I mean, a way to try and quantify how long it is, just calculate the percent of error, it's about 5.5%, so it's reasonable, but I don't know, but depends on the problem, the level of accuracy that you need from your...
Well, that's a good point. I mean, so part of it depends on, you know, if I'm just trying to understand, you know, general principles of, you know, is this going to nuke me if I'm in the lab, or if I leave enough of this sitting around in 2 days, am I going to have a problem with radiation contamination? You know, that's probably a reasonable enough number. On the other hand, if I'm really trying to understand nuclear physics, 5.5% might be pretty bad. Kenny, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, that's what we were talking about. We were just saying how far off can it be before we say it's not good.
And not just that, what direction.
Right, we didn't know what value that
would be.
But I think that's something we should take into consideration, like how far off can it be.
Well, and if you were to look this number up, I think in the CRC, it would have a percent error or an uncertainty associated with the accepted value as well. What did you guys come up with?
I think one thing that you need to consider is how good is the accepted value?
Mm-hmm.
How did they determine the accepted value? Is it from an experiment? Is it an average from a couple different experiments? If it is an average, what kind of average is it? And then we'll have a better idea of whether the value that we got is good or bad compared to that. Also, if we could reduce our signal to noise ratio, we could say by collecting more data points.
Mm-hmm.
And that can improve the quality of the calculated half-life.
I think so. That's a good point, and you know, that's one of the ways that you can get at this idea of, you know, how good is the accepted value, how good is our value, is repetition. And so this is not an easy question to solve. You know, you would think we have all this statistical data on each of our data points, and there should be a way to say, well, if the uncertainty of my count, you know, my counts are 4 plus or minus 15, or 15 plus or minus 4, there should be a way to give me a plus or minus for this number too, right? Because if this is plus or minus 3, that's not too bad. I mean, maybe it's a little bit small. If it's plus or minus 0.3, well, then we know we got a problem, right? So the question is, how do we get that information out? One way, going back to this guy, and again, this is maybe not an entire course in statistics, but this is what statisticians think about, or what some statisticians think about. You could imagine that if the best value, and this is one-dimensional data, and I think it actually makes things simple, but if the best value here is right around 250, I could imagine if I go up, eventually I'm going to go up and I'm going to change my k to the point where chi goes from something that's fairly acceptable to something that's unacceptable. And if I go up on the left-hand side, I reach a point where the chi-squared becomes unacceptable. If I go up on the right-hand side, I reach a point where the chi-squared becomes unacceptable. And if I follow that, suppose that unacceptable point is here, well, that means k can go from 250 to a max of about 350. And if I follow it over here, to maybe about a minimum of about 200. So this is how you can start to rationalize error bars in your fitted parameter. Keeping in mind that if you change one parameter, if I change the half-life while keeping the background radiation and the initial value constant, and look at how chi-squared changes, eventually I'm going to reach a point where my chi-squared becomes statistically unacceptable. Numerically, that ends up being about 1. So if my chi-square goes from 0.4 to 1.4, that's one way to estimate the uncertainty of that parameter. It's not a particularly good way to do it, because what I just told you we had to do was hold the background radiation and the starting number constant. And then, you know, those might actually be interrelated. If I change chi-squared, or if I change my half-life a little bit, I might be able to make my chi-squared go back down again if I change the background radiation in an opposite direction. So manipulating the parameters and watching how chi-squared changes is one way to tackle this problem. Leaving data points out and watching how chi-squared changes is another way to tackle this problem. Right? For example, if my exponential decay fit if I leave this point out, which looks like it's a little bit off, and my decay time goes, crazy, it becomes some big different number, well, that means that, the value of my fit is very, very dependent on this one time point. And if I leave out enough time points at random and try refitting the data over and over again, eventually I get a distribution of parameters from refitting my data that I can possibly use to estimate, the uncertainty or how often or how big those parameters change. So that's another way to do this. That would be called either Monte Carlo types of approaches or jackknifing. A bootstrap is a slightly different approach of doing the same thing, where again you resample your data. And so I'm basically just throwing these terms out. You don't have time to cover what they all mean. But those are different ways of sort of looking at the data itself and understanding how the statistics of leaving points out or how individual points contribute to the value that we're fitting. So we've talked two ways now. So looking at the changing chi-squared, resampling the data. The third way that you could imagine is related to what Thomas also said, just do it again, right? Take this whole fit, put it on the back burner, go do the experiment again, and then refit. And you're going to get another value of the half-life from that new fit. You do that three times, now you have an average and a standard deviation of your fit, which tells you, how accurate your data seems to be. That's maybe not perfect, but that's in practice what we do a lot in our lab. So if we're doing a calorimetry experiment, we'll do that experiment three times, and we'll average the values that we get out of the fit. That is maybe the most labor intensive, because you've got to do the experiment three times. But there's a lot of goodness in that, right? Well, maybe not, maybe goodness isn't the right word, but there's a lot of advantages to doing it that way. Yes, it takes more time, too, but also you get statistics out, so that's great. So you can now put some error bars just from the average and standard deviation. It's very straightforward. You don't have to explain to a reviewer that I did 50,000 bootstraps resamples and reported the uncertainty of my parameter after fitting it 50,000 times. So it's very straightforward. Just say I did the experiment three times, reported the average and standard deviation, and then also it's third point. Don't get old. There's no transformation. I think that's probably good. It's good to know that you're doing the experiment right? I mean, you can do it once and get a value of it, and maybe you didn't realize that, the buffer solution that you were using was bad, or, the guy who used the instrument before you didn't clean it out properly. And so by doing it again three times, not only do you get the statistics, but you get a feeling for as Keith Hollis might say, are you working a miracle, or are you getting something that's actually scientifically reproducible? And so yes, it takes more work, but ultimately we probably should be reproducing our experiments more anyway. And particularly National Institutes of Health funding requirements are now big, because apparently they've gotten ticked off that too many people try to reproduce the data from the literature and it doesn't actually work. So you don't want to be in a situation where somebody goes and tries to reproduce your data and they can't. Best solution to that is try reproducing it yourself and making sure you get the same answer over and over again. And so those are some real definite advantages to being able to doing this, repetitively. You get statistics, it helps you sleep at night, and it's very easy to explain. Okay, That said, if you get a fit, how do you know it's a good fit? Well, and we've already covered this, so I'm not going to beat it to death. Again, at the very beginning of this lecture, I could have shown you guys this curve, and you would have said, yeah, that fit, that line goes through the data. And so that's sort of the simplest, but don't forget about it. Right? If you look at the model and the best fit parameters that you get out of that model, and it goes through the data, well, then that's probably a good sign. If it doesn't go through the data, well, then that's not a good fit. And so look at the data and see if they look good. That's sort of your first stop. Yeah, we've talked about normalized chi-squared or reduced chi-squared. If that reduced chi-squared value is less than 1, then, you know, again, that's also a good sign that the model and the data are in good agreement. And so that's the second way you can assess a fit. The third way we haven't talked about, but you can basically create what's called a residuals plot. And so a residuals plot is simply a difference between the observed data point, and the value that you calculate from the data. And so on the one hand, you can look at this data set and see, well, yeah, this guy is slightly higher than the model, this guy's a little bit lower, this guy's higher than the model, you know, this guy's really higher than the model, this guy's lower, you know, this guy falls right about on the curve. So you can look at the individual data points, but it's much easier just to plot that difference as a function of, in this case, time. If you go back into our Excel spreadsheet, you see there's a final tab here called residuals. And all I've done here is plotted the difference between the observed data and the model. And so you can see, looking at those data points, some of them go up, some of them go down. They're all about within one error bar. And there's no real systematic differences here. Right? So if I change my... If I changed my background, let's make this 11. You know, my reduced chi-squared is still small. It's still less than 1. But if I look at my residuals plot, particularly as I get out here, you can see that they're systematically less than 1. Right? And I can make that a little bit more pronounced. Oops. So looking at your residuals, it's crystal clear that there's something up here. Your model is consistently over-predicting the data, and you know the difference between your model and the data is frequently negative. And so by plotting the difference, it can become very easy to see situations where, yeah, maybe the curve fits really well in some region of the graph, but in other regions of the graph, maybe it doesn't fit well at all. And so a residuals plot is a way to very rapidly and pretty robustly assess whether you have a good fit, even in the absence of looking at chi-squared. Keep in mind here, now my chi-squared is definitely big, it's 2.6, but I could possibly make that smaller if I optimize the initial height and whatnot. So let's try that. Let's make this 130, 120. So here again, that doesn't look terrible, but it becomes really obvious when I look at the residual plots that there's something up with this fit. Okay. And so here you can see some examples. Here's the model over predicting the data. We just looked at that. Here's a case where the parameters don't quite work, and so you end up with oddness in the residuals. you can see that, that we can come up with sort of a systematic approach to doing this. You know, obviously when you're building a biochemical model, oftentimes if you're doing research, your advisor will give you something. Say, this is the model that we use to fit this data. Secondly speaking, always keep it in that order. You never fit your data to the model. That would be scientifically unethical. Fitting your model to the data is perfectly fine. And so, you know, there's a difference, you know, it's just pedantic. But it is a technical difference that, you know, you are fitting parameters in the model, you're not changing your original data to make it agree. But you come up with a hypothesis about the system, you try to figure out how to get that into a mathematical model, and you might have to do some derivation at this point. You design an experiment where you can test that, or you can test the observable that you think is important. And then finally, you optimize your model and you see if the fit looks convincing. Right? And so, as a real practical example of this, this is an example from one of the labs here at Lewis. He has G quadruplex and it binds this molecule TMPYP4. There's obviously an interaction between these two. It can be defined by the association constant. Of interaction, so tight binding usually means high association constant. But they don't know intrinsically what the association constant is going to be when they first start. The other thing that's sort of uncertain about the model is how many binding sites. You know, it's known that this sort of planar molecule comes in and fits in the grooves of the DNA. But you can imagine that there's two sites here, but there might be one on the bottom, there might be one on the top. So, you know, that's a parameter too. How many binding sites? We don't know. But they can derive, using mathematics, a generalized model for how binding should look given a specific equilibrium constant and a specific number of binding sites. And so, you know, again, we're not going to work through biochemistry class examples, but, you know, your model might look something like this. DNA plus ligand or TMPYP4. Gives you a complex with one, it can bind another, gives you a complex with two, it can bind a third, you go all the way up to N. So we don't know, maybe there's stuff binding on the sides, who knows. But we do assume, and it's always good to know what your limitations are, in the model that we're going to derive, we assume that all equilibrium constants are identical. So that is to say, if it binds the first one in the middle, it's going to have the same equilibrium constant as if it binds the one at the top or on the sides. Might not be a great model in that sense, but you've got to start somewhere. And so it's when you're enumerating or when you're first starting out with a model, you might not necessarily know whether it's the best model, but you do some experiments, you check the result, and if you need to refine, you go back and refine. Our model for the solar system didn't come out of a single set of investigations. It came out of, you know, years, hundreds of years of people looking at things and seeing how they behave and calculating what the orbits of planets should be and using that information to go back and to refine the model later on. When you do all this, the equation that you end up with is the degree of binding. Again, you can think of that as sort of the fractional saturation, although this here goes from 0 to n. Where n is the number of binding sites. This is our equilibrium constant, and this is the concentration of free or unbound TMPYP4. And so to be able to test this model, we have to be able to measure nu. We have to be able to measure the concentration of unbound TMPYP4, and then we can change N and K to optimize the agreement between our model and our observations. Okay, so our parameters are going to be K and N, and nu and L are the values that we can measure experimentally. And so I'm giving you guys this data. We can maybe try to fit it ourselves in the time remaining. We have a little bit of time. And what we're going to basically see is, you know, here's the data. You can see that we can fit. So the black points with the error bars are our data points. And now we have three different lines, one corresponding to n equals 3, one corresponding to n equals 4, one corresponding to n equals 5. Of those three, you can see how they have different values or different behaviors of the model. And if we optimize the equilibrium constant, you can sort of see, and we'll hopefully get a chance to do this in a second, you can sort of see that n equals 4 looks like, you know, it has a pretty good agreement with all of the data points. I haven't plotted the residuals here, I haven't given you chi-squared or anything like that, but you can see that using this, we can get out information that would otherwise be unknown, that is the number of binding sites, and we can determine that using some experimental measurements. Now, we're going to go into a little bit of a demo here on nuplot. You have a much more detailed description in this introduction to nuplot for chemists. Okay, and so we probably won't get through all of this stuff. That's not even my goal today. My goal is to show you a practical example of how we can fit the specific data. But if you want to learn a little bit about using nuplot, this handout has it there for you. And you know, we talked about using Excel and the solver function as a means of optimizing model parameters and getting out model fits using a very straightforward approach. The disadvantage to Excel is that what you have to do is you have to set up all of those differences, you have to set up chi-squared, you have to give an equation for chi-squared, you have to put all of your model parameters in one place and then tell the solver to change this while you monitor that. And Excel doesn't even give you information about, you know, the error bars in any of the approaches. So it can't do the chi-squared approach, and it can't do any kind of bootstrap resampling. Now, nuplot can't really either. So the only thing you could really do with Excel is you could do the experiment 3 times, take the average, and report the standard deviation, the standard error, the mean. Nuplot will use the chi-squared trick, so change the functions as a function of, you know, change the parameters and look at chi-squared, and it will be able to give you estimates on the uncertainty of your parameters. And I think this is the simplest program out there that will do that. You don't have to put in any functions or chi-squared equations. And the approach for optimizing the model is quite simple. That said, it's not trivial, and you will have to sort of go through that tutorial if you want to be able to do this independently by yourself. But let's sort of take a look. So if you want to work along, this is great. This is a good opportunity to practice some of those Linux skills. You can install nuplot on a Mac or PC. And so you don't have to use Linux to use nuplot. I have it installed here on my Windows system. All right, so if I type nuplot, yeah, I can run it natively on Windows. There's no problem with that. But I think it's good to sort of reinforce some of the Linux stuff that we've already talked about. Okay, so if I go here to the website, I have my binding data that I have right here. And this might be hard for Caitlin, who's using the Mac, because we have to transfer that file. But really, if you're using SSH Secure Shell client, transferring files to different machines is trivial. You just drag and drop. Well, it doesn't close the connection.
Is this supposed to be on this
remotely? Oh, yeah, it is. Sorry. Okay, so there's my connection on block. Here's the binding.txt file. Just going to drag that over, and look, it's already there. Yeah, it's slightly smaller. That's interesting. And now here's my Linux window, and I'm going to connect. So this would be, you would do this in Secure Shell client if you followed Yua. So this is actually a little bit more similar to what you would do in a Mac. Okay, so now I'm logged into Block. You can see I have even more files than Yua does in my home directory. It happens, and as you accumulate cruft, I could probably delete about 2/3 of these. And X Windows is working, so if I run X Eyes, well, I'm trying to convince you that it's working, but there we go. So X Windows is working. And now that I'm on Linux, I can run the program nuplot. It's very simple. I just type nuplot. And those of you who were paying attention when I opened it on Windows, you know, this information here looks very similar to what comes up when I type it and I will run it on Windows. So again, I'm using a slightly different version. This is 4.4 patch 3. This is 5 patch 4. But nuplot doesn't change that much. If you don't have the latest version, it's fine. And nuplot is an extremely powerful program in that you can do all sorts of interesting things. So in one sense, it's like a graphing calculator. So if I type plot sine of x, it brings up a window and you can see that it's plotting sine of x. So that's nice. I can leave that window up if I want. I don't have to, but it's there. Suppose I only want to look at the first period of sine of x. I can go in and I can use brackets to specify 2 times. So I can say look from 0 to 2 pi. And now it just gives me the single period of the sine wave. I can do other types of things. Oh man, I don't have arrows. Maybe I do.
What's XI supposed to do?
It's just a fun utility to make sure that you have X Windows working. The eyes follow your mouse around.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's a total time waster. Maybe I have to close that window. Okay, apparently I do. I can plot sine x over x, 3.14159. And so you can see that it gives you a window here where it shows you the graphs. You can do some scrolling and, you know, zoom out. Now this is kind of slow. Again, you're working from a remote system and it's trying to send all the graphics information over the internet. So it's not exactly the fastest thing in the world. But we can still use it. And if we want to look, you know, the file that we put all that binding data in is called binding.txt. So in addition to plotting random functions, you can have it plot information, right? And so here it's plotted the data from the binding.txt in an XY scale, so from 1 to 10. Now that file also has error bars, and so you can use the abbreviation with Y error bars. Okay, there we go. Don't type the period. And so now you can see it's plotting from, now for some reason it's using a logarithmic scale, which is not what I want it to do. But that's interesting. There's a whole bunch of functions in here that you can set.
Where are we supposed to set? save the binding.txt?
I just dragged it into my home directory. So my home directory has all this stuff in it, and I just dragged it into the home directory, and then I started new plot from the home directory. So if you drag the binding.txt into bootcamp, the directory that was made when you untarred that file, you'll have to start new plot from the bootcamp directory. All right, so if I go in here, I can quit out of this quick. Now again, if I pick print working directory, I'm in /home/nfitsky. And if I do a directory listing, that binding.txt file is there. Now if I go into another directory, say temp, and I do a directory listing and binding.txt file isn't there, and I try running new plot and plotting binding.txt, it's not going to work because it assumes that you're in the directory that you started in. And so if your binding.txt is in the home directory, then you want to start new plot from the home directory. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out where to put it.
Okay. I can't tell you where you put it, but I'll take a look maybe after the session.
I know it's in desktop. I'm just...
Okay. So then you would go, if it's in desktop... Usually, the desktop directory is a capital D-E-S-K, so it's usually off of your home directory. And if you type pwd, it should be /home/ your username. In this case, it'll be on the bootcamp drive, and then /desktop. And if I wanted to, I can move binding.txt to the current directory, and now it's there. And if I start new plot again, I can plot it. And now it's not using an assign thing. Maybe that was because I used, or now it's not using logarithmic points. So that might be because I was doing something sine x over x, which has an infinite value at 0. So that could be what was going on, even though the limit is 1. Anyway, so we have this data. How do we fit our model to the data, right? So going back to our slideshow, the model that we want to fit is nu is equal to n times k times l over 1 plus k times l. And so within nuplot, I have to give it that function. So that I still have to define that function somehow. And so I'm going to do nu of x. So I'm defining a new function. It's a function of x. I could also make it nu of l if that makes it a little easier. And it would be n times k times l divided by 1.0. It's always a good idea to put decimal numbers if you're specifying numbers in the computer. So I put 1.0 or 1. Plus k times l. Now this is going to, it worked. So it took that, it didn't mind. Now again, I have to tell the computer what are some approximate values I might use. I have to give it some starting guesses. And this is really true for all minimization algorithms. Computer can't just pull a number out of the air and say, I'm going to start here and then minimize from there. You have to give it some reasonable starting values. And so I'm going to say n is equal to, again, let's do 2.0. And let's give it as an equilibrium constant 1.0E5. Okay, and so now I can go in, I can actually go and plot that, see what it looks like. Apparently not. There we go. Now, clearly, I can't have negative concentrations. So that's a problem. So I'm going to give myself a positive range, 0, to 1.0E3. Okay, minus 3. And so it looks like a binding curve. It starts out at 0, and eventually at high concentrations it ends up at 2, which is what I would expect. If I've added a boatload of TMPYP4 or a boatload of ligand, I would expect both of those sites to be saturated. So I would expect a maximum value of 2. But now what Nuplot can do is it can go in and it can actually try to optimize this function against the data that you give it. And so the command to do that is called the fit command. And the syntax is given in the Nuplot tutorial function. But basically what you gotta do is you gotta type fit, and then we would use new of x, because that's the function that we're fitting to. We give it the name of the data that we want to try to have it model. So we say, okay, use binding.txt. And now there's some additional sort of syntax stuff that comes in. We tell it to use all three columns in our data file. So we say using columns 1 and 2 and 3. It has the assumption that if the third column is extra, right? You have an x and a y term. That third column, it assumes, is going to be your uncertainty. And so it'll use that for calculating the chi-squared value. So we say using 1, 2, 3. And then we have to tell it what are the parameters we want you to fit, right? Because I have, in this case, n and k are both free parameters. But suppose I had some constant like pi or the gas constant. I don't want it to try to fit the gas constant. I know what the gas constant is. So I have to tell it what parameters I want it to use when making a fit, or what I want it to leave out and leave constant when calculating the value of nu. And so I say via, and I don't know why they chose via, but and I list the parameters that I want it to calculate. Okay, and so now I'm going to hit enter, and hopefully it works. Yeah, and so if it works, you'll see it runs through a whole bunch of iterations where, again, it's iteratively trying to find that minimum of chi-squared. It's not psychic. It doesn't know off the top of the head what it should be. It's basically sampling that surface and trying to find the right parameters of chi-squared that give you the minimum value. And when it's finished, if everything works okay, it gives you a value of n plus or minus error. It gives you a value of k plus or minus error. It shows you some correlation graphs, so that's something for a different lecture. But you can use those, and if I look here, I type print n, it's set the value of n and k to be the best fit values that it found. And now what we can do is if we're curious, we can say, okay, plot binding.txt with y error bars. And if I wanted to plot multiple things in the same graph, I just separate them by column. So I'll say, okay, new of x. And so now it's going to plot both the data and the fit on the same graph, hopefully. And you can see what that fit looks like. And so now you can start to assess, is this a good fit? Does it match up with what I would expect it to be? Is 3.7 plus or minus 0.35, is that a good value for the number of binding sites? All of those things go into making this assessment. And if you look again at the new plot tutorial, it'll show you how to do things like plot a residuals plot on the same curve and how to make this graph a little bit more user-friendly or maybe not publication quality, but a little bit more professional looking with some x-axis and y-axis labels and things like that. And so, again, we didn't have to enter any fancy equation. We just entered the model into our new plot program. We gave it the data, and then it does a good bit of the fitting for us. And so it's a very powerful tool in the sense that not a lot of programming is involved, and it can get you the uncertainties, at least estimates of the uncertainties, for your parameters when you do a fitting example. And the example in the new plot is different. It's a linear fit, but the same kind of principles apply. You can fit for the slope and the intercept and get parameters out from that. Okay. I think that's about where we end for today. We've covered a lot today. We've started out with proteins. We've worked our way up through databases, and we've ended with using Linux and showing how some very useful tools in Linux can be used to understand biochemical models. I know it's been kind of a brutal day. Now you have some time to go home and soak it in and let your mind relax. I think I'm going to go home and not say another word for the rest of the day so my voice recovers for tomorrow. But are there questions on what we've covered here? Yeah.
What is the take-home lab?
So the take-home lab is the new plot tutorial.
Oh.
You know, again, nobody's going to be looking over your shoulder to see if you did it or not. But if you want to learn a little bit more about how new plot works, that's sort of the activity that you could do if you're bored and you don't want to go out tonight. You can do that from your hotel room or from your dorm room. So it's there as an option. Yeah?
Do you ever do the same kind of progression like MATLAB or R?
So I do not use MATLAB as much. We have it here. The university has a site license. And some of my students do use it for some things. So I believe Yua and Dinesh have used it in their research. The challenge with MATLAB, so MATLAB has a lot of nice features. The challenge is getting the statistics out usually requires you to know a little bit more programming, or you have to buy the model fitting toolkit, which is an additional cost to an already extremely expensive program. And the goal of this is sort of, we want to use tools, or we want to show students how to use tools that even if they go back to their university and they don't have access to MATLAB, for example, they can still get something out of it and make some progress. And so we do use MATLAB. Personally, I actually use a lot of R because I think R is it's maybe not as powerful as MATLAB, but it's better suited for statistics. But it still requires a lot of programming to get all of the statistical information out of R that I might want.
What do you usually use to produce like publication?
So for publication ready figures, we actually use the program that Yua showed you, Grace. MATLAB's great. Grace is actually great too. Lots of people will use Origin. Again, that's also another pay for product. Grace is free, but the challenge with Grace is that you generally have to take your figures and sort of touch them up in Illustrator afterwards. And so in my lab, the typical workflow is, when you're doing your lab notebook, Excel is fine, Grace is great. I don't care if it's publication quality. But when you're ready for publication, either you really know how to use Excel, and it's possible to make publication quality figures in Excel. It just takes some effort. But most of my students will use Grace, and then they'll load them into Acrobat, make sure that the font sizes and the size of the figures and everything else is in line, and then that's what we'll submit. It takes extra effort. If I expand this program to a week, I might include a section on Illustrator because I do think it's an extremely valuable program. But for now, I'm trying to focus on the free stuff. But even if I were using MATLAB, I would still probably want to look at Illustrator and make sure that the fonts are all good. And so if I'm going to be using Illustrator anyway, I may as well use the software that's free. So that's sort of been my approach to it. Lots of people have different approaches, and I would say you guys should use whatever Rob tells you to use. And he might tell you to use MATLAB, and in which case, all of these programs, Newplot can do publication quality figures as well. It's a matter of how much time you want to spend. And I tend to give my students a lot of flexibility. As long as the result looks good, I don't ask a whole lot of questions about what programs they're using. If the result doesn't look good, then I'll definitely stick my nose in and say, well, this is how you should do it. But ultimately, it's really what gets you the end result. And if somebody really comes in and they're just a superstar using Excel and can make Excel graphs that look, you know, outstanding, then I'm not going to say to them, you have to switch. Because I want them to be productive and use the programs that they know. But this is maybe showing you programs that you might not know that now you hopefully can realize are available to you. That's a very long and probably unsatisfying answer to what you hoped would be a straightforward question.
Well, not exactly. I know you said something about maybe expanding the program to a week. I think I saw there's something about, like, you wouldn't quite call this publication quality, but it's certainly getting there.
Yeah.
What about, doing, another segment on how to create,
Yeah, no, that would definitely be something we could do. In a slightly longer section. And so that's a really good idea. We don't have time for it this week, but maybe next year. Other questions? Okay, go home, relax, and we'll see. Remember, the starting time tomorrow, I believe, is at 9, not 8. And we'll start out with something completely different, which is laboratory safety and chemical waste. And so for the chemical waste in particular, there'll be some extra people here because lots of folks in our department need to get their chemical waste recertified every year. So, but lab safety should just be us again.
Same room, 9 o'clock.
Same room, 9 o'clock. Okay. I'm going to lock it, but I wouldn't leave your stuff here because custodians come in and they may not lock the door when they leave.